Live from New York City, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. Nice to have you with us today. We're here to talk about the issues that impact our lives. And of course, living a longer and healthier life, that's part of it. But also, it's about looking at the issues that can keep us from living a longer and healthier life. And I'll get into that more on an upcoming special. In fact, I'm spending an entire hour showing you the progenitor, the beginning of the modern health movements, the organic movement, the raw food movement, back to the land, the environmental villages, the community villages, animal rights. All these different movements had a beginning or carried on from what was done before them. So I'm going to show you what came before us, who we owe some respect to, sometimes going back 100 or 200 years. If I mentioned the graham cracker, many of the older people would understand the graham cracker, but there was a man named Graham, and he was a major advocate of juicing back in the 1800s, where they didn't have electricity, but they had hydraulic presses, and they could press carrots and other vegetables. So that's coming at you soon. Today, we're going to share the latest on health and healing, but then I'm going to do a commentary, share a commentary from Chris Hedges called The Pandora Box of War. And also today, time permitting, five truths you should know about Islam, from Faisal Kuti, from Counterpunch. I'll also be looking at challenging the mainstream media and the administration about the crocodile tears they shed for the recent victims of the gas, but we're not sure it was sarin gas. In fact, there's no evidence it was sarin gas, explosion that occurred in Syria. But also today, we're going to take it a little further. We're going to talk about the truth about the Syrian conflict. In fact, there has never been a civil war. And who's telling you this? Well, a special commission of scholars who on their own time and dime went to Syria, had access to anyone they wanted to interview, and did. Also, we'll talk about the ex-Marine who challenges a neocon on why we're in Syria. And I thought it would also be appropriate to have on someone we've had in the past, John Perkins. He wrote The Confessions of Economic Hitman. He was the first to come forward who told us the truth of what really happens when it involves regime changes or wanting to exploit the resources of a country. And how do they get all those loans from the World Bank? So we're going to explore that as well. If time permits, we will open our lines to talk back. Also, you may not know it, but there is a movement afoot by Saudi Arabia to hire one of the most important lobbying law firms in Washington, D.C., who's hiring ex-vets to lobby their legislators to repeal the law that was signed that allows victims of 9/11 to sue the Saudi government. We'll have on one of the chief architects of that lawsuit, a victim of 9/11, to tell you what no one else in the media has told you. Tomorrow, the truth about Saudi Arabia being complicit in the planning and financing of 9/11. And the fact that our intelligence agencies knew this, the President of the United States and his family, the Bushes, who had done business with Saudi Arabia, who Saudi Arabia had been their partners in different deals, they were all aware of it. Well, tomorrow you'll be aware of it as well. So that's what we have coming at you. Now let's begin, as we always do, with the latest on health and healing. I'm a big believer in green spaces. In fact, when I complete my filming on two different documentaries where I'm doing this now. I will be making a search somewhere in the tri-state area of finding an old farm that over a period of a year can be rehabilitated into a green space for the youth in cities to go to, school trips, or people on weekends can bring their kids up where they can learn about nature. They can learn about trees talking to one another. They can learn about the healing power of nature and animals, all the animals be rescued animals. And when a child sees a chicken jumping up on their lap and they're petting it, and then they see a film of how that chicken would have ended up had it not been rescued, had it been in a factory farm, the child is very impressionable, and they don't want a chicken to be killed. They want a chicken they can love. And that's true of a lamb, a little veal calf. So we'll be having a theater there. Inside the theater, there'll be a series of screens, much like at the Museum of Natural History. We can go into like a little room where there's three benches and 10 people can sit, and there's a loop film, 10 to 15 minutes, and you can learn something. And so factory farming will be one of them. Organic will be one of them. Paying attention to the quality of our water and how to keep water pure and what causes water to be polluted. Everything that children should be learning but are not. That's my goal. And I've achieved the other goals of having a place for homeless vets to live and homeless people. So on to that project. But in any case, University of York found that when we're in a very busy urban environment, green spaces are extremely important because they can trigger changes in levels of excitement and engagement and frustration in the brain. Research at the University of Wharton, Edinburgh, say that the findings have important implications for architects and planners and health professionals as they deal with an older population. Now, here's the key. The older you are, the more green space you should spend time in. The study is a part of a larger project looking at mobility and mood and place and the role of the urban environment in prolonging and promoting health and well-being. And as people get older, they found by using EEGs, which is electroencephalograph, they found that the more time they spent around trees and grass, natural settings, the healthier their brain, the more it did for them in keeping them calm, less anxious, less depressed. And I fully support that, and I believe that we must have far more green spaces than what we currently have. Now, here's an idea. Why not look at our existing infrastructures in cities where there's little to no real green spaces, in inner cities like Newark and Camden, New Jersey, and get the city to donate 2, 3, 4, 5, 10 blocks. It's all, nothing's there, no one lives there. Bulldoze those, and then have an urban renewal where people within the community, along with these green architects, and people committing to building an actual green environment, building a lake with waterfalls, and meditation gardens, and a Zen garden, all within communities. That does not exist now, but there's no reason that it couldn't. Anyone who wants to participate in that, let me know. You can contact my office in New York, and we'll put you on a list. When I get back, I'm going to be contacting at least 100 communities, cities, and asking would they donate land for these community spaces. Higher vitamin D and DHEA, about 20 milligrams of DHEA and about 3,000 units of vitamin D, help men over the age of 50 be less fragile. This is according to the European Male Aging Study. And they looked at a lot of men over a period of time and found that they're generally deficient in DHEA sulfate. and also insulin-like growth factor, IGF-1, and binding protein, and they had a whole lot of deficiencies. And that means that you lose muscle mass, your bones thin, you don't have energy, you just become the stereotypical aging man. There's no reason for that. You can regain your posture, you can regain your muscle mass, you can regain your strength and stamina and endurance. So start by having vitamin D and DHEA, because DHEA is what creates, it's the master hormone from which your other hormones are created to give you muscle mass, to give you bone strength. So that's important. There was also a study done in Medicine and Health for medical research, published in Lipids and Health and Disease, that showed that there are compounds found in extra virgin olive oil that can reverse some of the negative effects of a high-fat diet. Well, since most people in Western cultures have adapted to a high-fat animal-based diet, this specific nutrient called hydroxytyrosol is able to reverse markers of insulin resistance and non-alcoholic fatty liver disease in this particular experiment. So, the takeaway message, make sure that you're having a tablespoon of organic, cold-pressed, extra virgin olive oil every day. And that can help you to have better fats in your body, healthier liver, and less likely to manifest metabolic syndrome, prediabetes and diabetes condition. It reduces liver enzymes that are inflammatory also. So it's all good. Now, this is something new, so imagine how many other nutrients in olive oil they have yet to discover what it can do, but it's just one of the finest things we can put in our body. From two universities in Greece, they found that colostrum, which, by the way, is the most nutrient-rich milk on earth, it's what comes out immediately upon delivering a baby in cows and mares, horses, sheep, goats, it doesn't matter. This is where the mother load of nutrition goes into the whatever it's suckling, whether it's a baby with a breast or in a cow. And it's what helps with the immune system. It gives you all of the proteins. Now they have found, based upon this university study, that approximately 3.2 grams, that's 3,200 milligrams, that's not a lot. Give you an idea, 3 grams, that would be about a quarter of a teaspoon. They found that it can reduce muscle damage and inflammation after an exercise. It would be particularly important for people who are doing exercise like soccer and rugby, tennis, basketball, football, where you can really rip and tear muscles, where you really can exhaust certain types of muscles. And what they found was after 6 weeks, the recovery rate of people taking this colostrum was substantially increased, in creatine kinase and C-reactive protein being lowered. And that's important because you don't want those elevated because it increases heart disease. So, something to help the athletes. Also, we're finding something new that we haven't had in the past in America. And this is from the CDC, so it's mainstream. And what they did is for a period of 1 year, they looked at 141,000 people starting at age 18 and who were admitted to hospitals for stroke. And now the number has gone up, and 171,000, these are young people. And so strokes are typically associated with older people, or people who smoke or drink or who are obese. And they're saying strokes are occurring at an extremely rapid rate in younger people. Quote, our results stress the importance of prevention of stroke risk factors in younger adults. And so What did they say? Well, they want you to have less high blood pressure, diabetes, high cholesterol, and stop tobacco use and obesity. It means nothing. It's absolutely wasted verbiage. They didn't say, stop eating French fries, hot dogs, hamburgers, pretzels, bagels, bacon and eggs, soft drinks, coffee, and alcohol. Had they said that, then a person would say, okay, now I know why I'm getting a stroke. They also didn't tell you what you could do to help prevent a stroke, which would be thinning the blood. They're going to tell you to take a baby aspirin. What they don't tell you is, yes, it will thin the blood, but anywhere from 24,000 up, and some believe as high as 40,000, will die every year in the United States from taking aspirin because it causes bleeding. But there's something worse than that. Aspirin destroys folic acid, B6, B12 in the body, and vitamin C. Those are all important to keeping a very deadly biomarker down, and that is homocysteine. So when homocysteine gets up around 12, 13, 14, 15, you're at a really high risk of stroke. So what they should say is take a high complex B vitamin, such as 1 milligram of methylated folic acid, 1 milligram of methylated B12, 50 milligrams of vitamin B6, and 2 to 3,000 milligrams of vitamin C a day. That's just to keep the homocysteine level down, because the irony of it is you could reduce the risk of stroke with an aspirin and increase your risk of a heart attack at the same time. This is the monotheistic, reductionistic mindset of American medicine and science. To anyone with a brain, you realize, boy, they just can't they see it? Yes and no. It all depends upon the amount of money they're making from research and how indoctrinated they are into a single principle of disease. So, you can also take cayenne pepper. Cayenne's much better than aspirin. Vitamin E, especially around 800 units, 400 in the morning, 400 in the afternoon. Coenzyme Q10, oxygenating the tissue of the heart. L-carnitine at 2,000 milligrams, oxygenating the heart, creating better mitochondria so the heart doesn't struggle to pump. Magnesium, so you have more even enzyme activity in the heart and you're relaxing the heart and you're evening out irregular beats like AFib. Simple things, not difficult. And of course, vitamin C, which also helps thin the blood. Also, life skills are important for well-being in later life. This is from University College London. Life skills such as, well, let's say persistence, conscientiousness, and control are as important to wealth and well-being in later life as they are when people are much younger. 5 life skills: emotional stability, determination, controlling yourself, optimism, and conscientiousness play roles in promoting educational and occupational success in early life, but we thought it wasn't important later life. Oh, yes, it is an important later life, so you shouldn't stop being disciplined and focused on what you do, because this will show that you are less depressed, you have less social isolation, you have better health, and fewer chronic diseases. They studied and followed 8,000 men and women for a long period of time and to come up with this. You also have lower cholesterol, lower C-reactive protein, which is the marker I just mentioned of inflammation relevant to a number of different diseases. You have smaller waistlines, you have less fat accumulation, you have better metabolic and cardiovascular markers if you simply maintain those qualities. I'm Gary Noll. Back in a moment. We have a lot more to go. Please stay with us. I'd like to welcome all of you from all over the world. We are in a time where there's a great deal of uncertainty. First, the mainstream media and much of the alternative media, including Democracy Now, in my personal opinion, are extremely biased. I believe that Democracy Now! Is the new voice of corporate liberal America, especially with its support of the mainstream or the neocon agenda in Syria and Libya. But that's my own personal opinion. So there's confusion abounding. Will there be war? And if so, when and how it will begin? War opens a Pandora's box of evils that was once unleashed are simply beyond anyone's control. In fact, I'm so adamant on this that we are bringing in the next couple of days one of the world's leaders on nuclear weapons. What do I believe? I believe that the neocons are in full control now. I believe Mr. Kagan in Washington, that Victoria Nuland and the Kagan family, she was the one who helped with the Hillary Clinton State Department execute what amounts to a coup in the Ukraine. They need and support war. They supported the invasion of Iraq, yet no one holds them accountable for being wrong and the carnage that left them. Well, Chris Hedges has a different perspective on it, and one we should pay attention to, because what will happen if Trump sides completely with the neocons, trusts the generals, all of whom are pro-globalization. These are neoconservative agendas. They want regime change, and now they have a president who is so simple-minded, so incapable of even any intellectual reason at all, that he will side with them. And it wouldn't surprise me if he then puts nukes in South Korea and then thinks he can do a preemptive strike. Big mistake. A lot of people in that area of the world will die. But that wouldn't bother the neocons in the slightest. Did you notice how many liberals came out on behalf of the strike in Syria, including Hillary Clinton, who stated it was sarin gas? And exactly how would she know? No one knew what it was at the time that the orders were issued to retaliate. The invasion of Afghanistan is just one example. We were there to defeat Al-Qaeda, and nearly 16 years later, we're embroiled in a losing fight with the Taliban. Now, we believe we could invade Iraq and create a Western-style democracy and weaken Iran's power in the region. The fragmentation of Iraq among warring factions has left Iran, the dominant Muslim nation in the Middle East, and Iraq destroyed as a unified nation. We set out to topple President Bashar Assad in Syria, but then began to bomb the Islamic insurgents trying to overthrow him. We spread the war on terror to Yemen, Libya, and Syria in a desperate effort to crush regional resistance. Instead, we created new failed states and lawless enclaves where vacuums were filled by the jihadist forces we sought to defeat. We have wasted a staggering $4.79 trillion on death, destruction, and folly as our nation is increasingly impoverished and climate change threatens us with extinction. The arms manufacturer, who have a vested interest in perpetuating these debacles, will work to make a few trillion more before this act of collective imperial suicide comes to a humiliating end. In war, when you attack one force, you implicitly aid another. And the forces we assist by striking the Assad regime are the forces we ironically are determined to eradicate: Nusra Front, Al-Qaeda, and other Islamic radical groups. These are the same Islamic forces we, along with Saudi Arabia and Qatar, and Turkey and Kuwait, largely created and armed and funded at the inception of the civil war in Syria. They are the forces that have responded to the chaos caused by our misguided military interventions in Afghanistan, Iraq, Libya, Yemen, Somalia, and Pakistan. They are the forces that execute Western captives, slaughter religious minorities, carry out terrorism in Europe and the United States, and collect billions of dollars from smuggling refugees into Europe. They are at times our enemies, but also sometimes our allies. The jihadist savagery mirrors our own. The jihadists respond to our airstrikes and aerial drone attacks by using suicide vests and improvised explosive devices. They respond to our black sites and prisons such as Abu Ghraib and Guantanamo with basement cells that torture kidnapped captives. They respond to the ideology of Western secularism with an Islamic State. They respond to violence with violence. The Islamic militants in Syria, after Russia intervened against them in September 2015, were losing territory and losing financial revenue and support in the six-year war. And they were the ones who rejoiced this week when the United States fired 59 Tomahawk missile cruise missiles at Syria's airfield, reportedly the launching site for a chemical weapons attack that killed 86 people. The select moral outrage of the United States among both Democrats and Republicans over the alleged chemical attack is worrisome because it ignores America's primary responsibility for the wholesale carnage that has left hundreds of thousands dead and millions as refugees, including 4 million people from Iraq and 5 million from Syria. It ignores the 12,197 bombs we dropped on Syria last year. It ignores our role in creating the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria, ISIS, and our role in arming and funding these jihadists in Syria. We have made sure that the Syrians, 400,000 of whom have died, and half of whom have been forced from their homes during the war, have many options when it comes to dying. So this is what we have to understand. Why the moral outrage now among Americans? Why have we stood by as Syrians died daily? Why? We have been moot as schools, apartment blocks, mosques, and hospitals have been bombed into rubble. Where's the outrage about the deaths of thousands of other children, including those we killed recently in Mosul, when a March 17th coalition airstrike took the lives of as many as 200 civilians? Or are we not enraged by the Trump administration's flagrant violation of domestic law by carrying out an act of war without approval from Congress or the United Nations? Why do we lament these deaths, yet bar Syrian war refugees from entering the United States? Is American foreign policy to be dictated by the fickle emotions of Donald Trump, whose perception of reality appears to be obtained exclusively from a television screen? It's a sad state. But there are other aspects of this that we should examine. And here are some things that I believe you should contemplate. In 2015, the Physicians for Social Responsibility released a landmark study stating that the United States has killed upwards of 2 million Muslims alone since the start of the war on terror after 9/11. Let me repeat that. Physicians for Social Responsibility completed a study. We, the United States, not our allies, have killed 2 million Muslims. Now imagine there are 40 people in an extended Muslim family. So if you've got 40 people in an extended family, and if you kill 2 million, well, you're looking at 80 million people that you have forever isolated. And this was also a study conducted at the University of California, San Francisco Medical School. But there are gaps in the report. Additional research and accountings done by the Association for Genocide Scholars at the University of Manitoba and the United Nations have estimated 3 million killed in Iraq alone since the first Gulf War in 1991. 500,000 children alone died because of Bill and Hillary Clinton. Where were the feminist outbursts? Where were the demonstrations against her? You would think that if someone were personally responsible for sanctions that killed 500,000 children, that's genocide. And yet you found a way, a rationalization to support her? Then she is not the problem. The person who blindly supports a person who is engaged in crimes against humanity is a co-complicit partner. Then about 2 million in Afghanistan alone were killed for the same in the same period, and that's according to the University of Melbourne investigations. 900,000 children in Afghanistan died under the age of 5. Many included starvation as a cause due to the intervention of the United States. So the United States can take responsibility, and the people who support the regimes who conducted this and the media who praised it, you killed a minimum of 1.4 to 5 million children in two countries alone since 9/11. Wrap your mind around that, please. Because the liberal community, the corporate Democrat community, the conservative community, the neocon community, the overarching nemesis behind the scene, the hidden hand, have never once taken responsibility for a single death. But you should, because that's your responsibility. You supported the people who made the decisions. And I saw no marches. I have yet to see a single march against Bill and Hillary Clinton's causing 500,000 people to die, and Madeleine Albright on 60 Minutes saying it was worth it. Maybe not, had it been her children. Just last year, 926 Afghan children were killed. 207 children killed and over 1,000 injured in Pakistan by U.S. drone strikes. That's according to the Bureau of Investigative Journalism. The number of children killed in Syria thus far is in the thousands, and those not including those who died earlier from starvation due to drought. Since 2014, there have been 13,501 U.S. drone strikes that we know of across Iraq and Syria. Now imagine what it is to sit safely in a very comfortable chair in an air-conditioned bunker in the desert near Las Vegas with a support crew of anywhere from 6 to 8 people, and you have no proof whatsoever that anyone in the vicinity of where you are targeting someone is a jihadist, and more often than not, there is no concern. You don't even have proof that the people you're targeting are the people who are going to get hit with the drone. And so, when you have 13,501 drone strikes, imagine the real number of casualties, both dead and injured. And imagine how many of those drones were tipped with depleted uranium and therefore forever polluting the environment. And those people celebrate their life and their career, go home, have a normal dinner with their family, not realizing they could have decapitated little children. But there is no protest, not one, not a single demonstration in the United States. So from my perspective, it is rather hypocritical, and I hold that with extreme disdain, those who find self-righteous indignation when it comes to a detonation of what I believe at this point, until I find out tonight, and I'll have on my progressive commentary tonight, Ray McGovern, who's got new intelligence information that will clarify a lot of this. There were casualties. That is a tragedy. That we became so outraged that the media, both left and right, Democracy Now, everybody, lost their minds over. And yet, you couldn't find a single emotion to express against millions and millions of innocent dead people. We must include economic sanctions also as a military weapon. And here, civilians and children are the prime victims. Can't get medicines that a child needs, they die. Can't get antibiotics to stop infections, they die. Operating in some cases without anesthesia, because there is none. In United States-supported Israel, attacks on Gaza, and they're all U.S.-backed, in Operation Protective Edge, 1,460 innocent civilians were killed, 521 children, 253 women, 17,200 homes completely destroyed, no condemnation, no demonstrations, no marches against this U.S.-supported invasion of an apartheid, by an apartheid state. No even challenging that it's an apartheid state. American government media sickness to justify child deaths is palpably vulgar. Hence, I hold especially in contempt the loathsome coverage of all the mainstream and all the media, with few exceptions. There are legitimate websites out there, Common Dreams, Truth Dig, Countercurrents, that will tell you the truth. Most won't. The film American Sniper, when Navy SEAL Chris Kyle advances the idea that kids have to be killed in self-defense, and hence is praised. Our enemies kill kids too. The U.S. doesn't kill kids on purpose. We're told it's all collateral damage and can't be prevented. But war can be prevented. And show me starting with Vietnam or the Cold War before that. Show me how war has resolved conflict. Since World War II, the United States has been responsible for up to 30 million civilian deaths from 37 victim nations. Afghanistan, the U.S. is responsible between 1 to 1.8 million deaths during the war between the Soviet Union and Afghanistan by luring the Soviet Union into invading that nation. In Cambodia, U.S. bombing of Cambodia had already been underway for several years in secret under the Johnson and Nixon administrations, but when President Nixon openly began bombing in preparation for a land assault on Cambodia, it caused major protests in the United States against the Vietnam War. I was a part of that protest movement. The U.S. bears responsibility for not only for the deaths, but from the bombings also resulting in the creation of the Khmer Rouge, who in turn killed 2.5 million Cambodians under the leadership of Pol Pot. Even when Vietnam later invaded Cambodia, '79, the CIA was still supporting Khmer Rouge. In Colombia, one estimate is that 67,000 deaths have occurred because of U.S. support of the Colombian state terrorism. According to an Amnesty International report, more than 20,000 people were killed for political reasons in Colombia just since 1986, mainly by the military and its paramilitary allies. Amnesty International alleges that, quote, the U.S. supplied military equipment ostensibly delivered for use against narcotic traffickers was being used by the Colombian military to commit abuses in the name of counterinsurgency, end quote. In 1 year alone, 3,500 people were killed just in an average year in the U.S.-funded civilian war in Colombia. In Indonesia and East Timor, in December 1975, Indonesia invaded East Timor. This incursion was launched the day after U.S. President Gerald Ford and Secretary of State Henry Kissinger had left Indonesia where they had given President Suharto permission to use American arms, which under U.S. law could not be used for aggression. The result was 200,000 dead out of a population of 700,000. On November 12, 1991, 217 East Timorese protesters in Dili, many of them children, marched from a memorial service, were gunned down by Indonesian Kopassus shock troops who were headed by U.S.-trained commanders. In fact, the son-in-law of General Suharto. And then they used U.S. trucks to dump the bodies into the ocean. From 1993 to 1997, the U.S. provided the dictatorial Indonesian government with almost $400 million in economic aid and sold tens of millions of dollars of weapons to that nation. Using green berets, provided training for the Indonesian elite force, which was responsible for many of the atrocities in East Timor. In El Salvador, the civil war from 1981 to 1992 was financed by $1 billion in U.S. aid given secretly to support the government in its efforts to crush a movement to bring social justice to the people in that nation of about 8 million. During that time, the U.S. military advisors demonstrated methods of torture on teenage prisoners. And according to an interview with a deserter from the Salvadoran Army published in the New York Times, this former member of the Salvadoran National Guard testified that he was a member of a squad of 12 who found people who they were told were guerrillas and tortured them, though there was never any proof presented that they were actually guerrillas. Part of the training he received was in torture at the U.S. locations in Panama. About 75,000 people were killed during that civil war. According to a 1993 United Nations Truth Commission report, over 96% of the human rights violations carried out during the war were committed by the Salvadoran Army or the paramilitary death squads associated with the Salvadoran Army. That commission linked graduates from the School of the Americas in the United States to those notorious killings. In Guatemala, in 1999, the Washington Post reported that a historical clarification commission concluded that over 200,000 people had been killed during the Civil War and that there had been 42,000 individuals who were violated and 29,000 were killed, 92% of which was committed by the Army. The commission further reported that the United States government and the CIA had pressured the Guatemalan government into suppressing the guerrilla movement by ruthless and torturous means. According to the Historical Clarification Commission, between 1981 and 1983, the military government of Guatemala, financed and supported by the U.S. government, destroyed some 400 Mayan villages in a campaign of genocide. In Haiti, from 1957 to 1986, Haiti was ruled by Papa Doc Duvalier and later by his son. During that time, their private terrorist force killed upwards of 100,000 people, all under the full awareness and total support of the U.S. and the CIA. Millions of dollars in CIA subsidies flowed into Haiti during that time, mainly to suppress any popular movements, union movements, any kind of activity that would challenge Papa Doc was put down. The United States-Iraq War and the sanctions against Iraq extended from 1990 to 2003. In 1995, the Food and Agriculture Organization of the United Nations reported that UN sanctions, that's Bill and Hillary Clinton against Iraq, were responsible for at least 560,000 children dying. In 1999, UNICEF reported 5,000 children died every 4 weeks in Iraq as a result of sanctions from the United States. Richard Garfield later estimated that it was far higher number. In fact, he said that it was 350,000 additional deaths. In the Iraq-U.S. war, starting in 2003, the most conservative figure I can find is from John Hopkins University, and that's 654,000 dead. the Israeli-Palestinian War, 200,000 dead. In Laos, from 1965 to 73, 200,000 dead. And those are, U.S. dropped 2 million tons of bombs on Laos. And that's more than was dropped in the entirety of World War II. In Nepal, between 8 and 12,000 Nepal citizens have died since the civil war broke out in 1996. And that's according to Foreign Policy and Focus. And that's a lot. And they were using American weapons. In fact, in Nicaragua in 1981, the Sandinistas overthrew the Somoza government in Nicaragua. And until 1990, about 25,000 Nicaraguans were killed in an armed struggle between the Sandinista government and U.S.-supported Contra rebels. In December 1989, in Panama, the U.S. invaded the country, ostensibly to arrest Manuel Noriega, that nation's president. This was an example of the U.S. view that it is the master of the world and can arrest anyone it wants to. For a number of years before that, Noriega had worked for the CIA, but fell out of favor, partially because he was not an opponent of the Sandinistas in Nicaragua. 2,500 to 5,000 people died. In the Philippines, can control the Philippines for hundreds of years, for over 100 years, and we have caused, under Marcos, 100,000 deaths. South Africa, under Operation Condor, or South America, I should say, this was a joint operation of six despotic South American governments, Argentina, Bolivia, Brazil, Chile, Paraguay, and Uruguay. And 13,000 people were killed under Operation Condor. In Vietnam, this is a big one because according to the Vietnamese government statement, the number of deaths of civilians and military personnel during the war was 5.1 million. And since deaths in Cambodia and Laos were 2.7 million, that means that the total amount of people killed over there was 7.8 million. In Yugoslavia, the CIA convinced the government to stay in power. There were 107,000 deaths. In Bosnia, 250,000 deaths. All told in Bosnia, Krajina. In Croatia, 15,000, Kosovo, 2,000, and so it goes. So here is my message. Yes, we should be outraged by any civilian death, especially children and those who are helpless. But it does not motivate us to seek diplomatic and responsible ways of coexisting. The entire Washington establishment is now one giant sinkhole of septic minds, sociopathic personalities, and some of the greediest people in the history of America. And that's the best I can say about it. Talk back next. Your opportunity to say what you have to say, 888-874-4888. 888-874-4888. Back in a moment. Please stay with us. And while we're waiting on your calls to come in, let me mention that we're going to hear a short clip, just a minute, 57 seconds, from John Perkins. He was on the inside, and he tells us what really goes on. Please listen to John Perkins.
The world's first truly global empire, and it's basically a secret empire. We do it many ways, but principally, we identify a country that has resources our corporations covet, like oil. Arrange a huge loan to that country from the World Bank or one of its sisters. The money never actually goes to the country. It goes to our own corporations to build big infrastructure projects in that country that help a few very wealthy people, but don't benefit the majority of the people who are too poor to buy electricity or have cars to drive on the highways, and yet they're left holding a huge debt that they can't repay. So we go back at some point and say, you know, you can't pay your debts. Give us a pound of flesh. Sell your oil real cheap to our oil companies. Vote with us on the next critical UN vote. Allow us to build a military base in your backyard. Something along these lines. And when we fail, the jackals go in and either overthrow or assassinate these leaders. And if the jackals fail, as they did in Iraq, then we send in the military. I don't think the failure is capitalism. I think it's a specific kind of capitalism that we've developed. We've created what I consider a mutant viral form of capitalism. And this mutant form of capitalism, which I think is really a predatory form of capitalism, has created an extremely unstable, unsustainable, unjust, and very, very dangerous world.
Mr. Perkins, who was a part of that, John Perkins, was one of the economic hitmen who would go in and meet with a leader of a country and say, you must do the following because our country wants to privatize your roads or your oil, and if you don't, you'll be killed. And he talks in an extended interview about how the people he liked, and they had too much integrity. They were too honest. And so they died in plane crashes. Or were assassinated. And I want you to hear what he has to say. It's a short clip.
The United States is in a perpetual state of war because the bankers control the politicians and they read the script as given to them by the banksters and they make huge amounts of money off of this. What this gentleman is saying about the United States not wanting war, not wanting to get involved is like Iraq 2.0. It's a repeat of the same rubbish that was said, oh, we don't want war, war is a last resort. That's absolutely untrue, it's a lie. Those that are in government are nothing more than prostitutes who are carrying out the orders of those who are in charge of them, and those that are in charge want another war. And part of that is what we discussed earlier, the Greater Israel Project, to destabilize any Arab regime which might have any kind of autonomy and self-determination. Any regime in the Arab world that is not an absolute puppet cannot be tolerated. And who are the nations that we target? Those that are not puppets. We don't target those like the Saudi regime, which is the biggest human rights violator in that region. It's cutting off people's heads in public, cutting off hands. It is the most grotesque regime on the planet, and yet we give that regime weapons, and it's no problem whatsoever. The duplicity and hypocrisy of the United States and the West can't even be measured. It is so enormous. And these mouthpieces, such as this gentleman in Washington, is only doing a disservice to himself and his country. And the fact is that American sons and daughters will get involved in this yet again, and these chicken hawks who are pretending to care about the Syrian people are going to be sacrificing not their own sons and daughters. I would like this man to send his sons and daughters and his grandchildren off to Syria when this turns into a greater conflict, because this is what we're flirting with, is a world war, a third world war. This is not a joke. We are flirting with a third world war on the basis that apparently we care so much about the Syrian people, just like we care so much about the Iraqi people and the Afghani people. The only people that buy this sort of stuff are either bought off prostitutes or the dumbest of the dumb. And we're also led to believe that Assad is the dumbest idiot dictator on the planet now, isn't he? Because he invited UN inspectors to come in and he brought them in on the very day that they come in, he decides to attack his own people 10 miles away from where the inspectors arrive. This is beyond ridiculous. And the only people that buy this, again, are bought off prostitutes or the dumbest of the dumb.
Add the New York Times and add all the other mainstream media into that criticism, because all of them back then and now support that Assad was using weapons of mass destruction. He was not. Seymour Hersh shows how that actually got in there. And why did the New York Times not focus upon the WikiLeaks emails that showed how she was supporting the use of terrorists in Libya, funding them, arming them, and then taking them from Libya into Syria? And that's why the embassy got attacked. That story had to be covered up, and that's unfortunate that we don't have anyone, it seems, in the media today willing to tell us the truth. And he is right when he says, I wouldn't say that they've been bought off, but boy, have they been impacted on their ability to be honest and objective. Oh, and I mentioned the other day that one of the worst sources of information that cannot be trusted, in my personal opinion, is, I said WikiLeaks, I meant Wikipedia. WikiLeaks is never made a mistake. Every single thing they have shared with us for the last many years, over 10 million documents, every single one has been shown to be authentic. And instead of looking carefully at those documents, which reveal the real inner workings of the corrupt governmental agencies and individuals like the Clintons and their schemes, instead we're saying, oh, but what they did was illegal. Yeah, good for them. I'm Gary Knoll. I'm going to thank you all for listening today, and hopefully you will listen tonight because I have a former CIA top person in analysis in who advised the president's national security advisor on a daily basis, and he's going to let us know a lot that is not even in the newspapers. 7 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, Progressive Commentary Hour tonight. Have a nice day, everyone.